Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in the book of Deuteronomy today, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 12. The parasha is Ikiv. But before I begin this parasha, I have a question for you. Now, this is a comparison question, just to think about in your past, your history, your knowledge, things that have taught you, people who have taught you, or things that you've learned on your own. How many of you are, I'm sure you're all very familiar with this, don't get me wrong, it's rhetorical in this part. Remember when Messiah was being tested, Satan gave him the three tests, you know, the three tests of, you know, the you're hungry, eat this food, or bow down and worship me, or those various things like that, right? With those tests, we'll read about that today. It's written in the Gospels. There's a few phrases the Messiah gave. He gave three basic answers to the tests he had received after that 40-day period of his trial, which, mind you, most of us would probably cave of 40 days without eating or drinking. I'm just saying, honestly, I'd probably give in. I'm not that strong of a person. I'd be very, very, very hungry. But I have a question for you. When Messiah cited, this is one of the questions, this question, just think about it in your head and in your past. When the food, the part of the food, which is in our Torah portion today, the citation about the bread, the man shall live by bread alone, but out of every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, right? In your past and in your history of when you were a child or growing up throughout your lives and as adults now, I'm sure you've heard preachings and teachings on that subject matter during that hit trials that he had to go through. I'm sure you've all have heard it different times. Some of you have all even given teachings on them for various times in your lives. What, or can you recall what some of the instructions or explanations were given for that parable, that story, meaning when Messiah gave that citation, what did that mean? What was he saying? What was he trying to relay to, not so much to Satan per se, because he already knows the Bible, but rather to everyone who was reading his story? Do you ask, think about that? What exactly was he saying? Is just because, you know, trust God? Is that all it was? What was he trying to explain to us? Sharon, you had your hand up? No, I don't know what you're going to say. Actually, it might be easier for those of you to refresh your memory. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to read the story. It's not very long. Chapter 4, not chapter 5. And just read the little story, and maybe it'll spark some of your memories and some of your thoughts, because this is part of our Torah portion. So Matthew chapter 4. Let's jump to Matthew chapter 4. I'm going to read this section. Messiah quotes a few statements in here, both from our Torah portion today. So Matthew chapter 4. I'm going to read this story to you. Matthew chapter 4 says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. And when the tempter came to him, he said, 'If you are the Son of God, command these stones become bread.' But he answered, 'It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God.' Then the devil took him up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple. He said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone.' And Jesus answered, 'It is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God.' And then, verse 8 says, 'Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. He said to him, all these things I will give to you if you will fall down and worship me. And Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. The devil left him, and behold, the angels came and ministered to him. In this story, we see, obviously, Matthias' different tests that the devil gave to him. What do you think he was talking about when he made these citations? What in your mind, in your vision, your viewpoint, what's he trying to relay to everyone who's reading it? Now, the devil already knows the answers. He knows the Bible. He's memorized every syllable there ever was. He knows it. Believe me, he knows it. So don't worry about that part. He's not trying to teach Satan something. Satan already has it all memorized. That's not the problem. What's he teaching us? Yes.
I would say the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life.
That's a fair. Those are the three examples of the different sins or temptations. That is true. What was he, the answer Messiah gave? What else do you have? Anything else? Yes, Myrna.
To me, he's saying we don't need to know why or how or anything. We just simply need to trust in him. I was reading Job, and I was just amazed that when God answered Job, he never did tell Job why all his children were killed, why he lost everything he ever had, but God just said, trust me.
That's true.
He never told Job why.
That's a great example. Anybody else? Larry, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
Well, he was the Word of God, for one thing. So Satan was trying to tempt him into not being himself. But I'm thinking that also the third one is one that I always have thought would be the most tempting to him, because he could go, yeah, I could. All I had to do is get this guy out of my way, and I could fix this all. Your Bible didn't say that. What he usually says is, "They are mine, and they are given to me."
Gospel sections record the story slightly differently from each other. So the Mark adds a few more details, and Luke adds a few details as far as they're the synoptics. So they're the three books. They'll tell the story in slight variations, like having three witnesses of the same story. They have their own perspectives they put onto it. So there's more to it. You can read Mark's citation of it, which I think is the first Mark chapter 1, I think it is. Yeah.
Satan did say that to him. He didn't say, you lie!
Right. He didn't accuse him of lying. That is true. And although, in my personal opinion, Satan probably could have given them to him temporarily. It's like, sure, it's yours. And then 2 weeks later, oh, bummer. It's gone. No, we'll discuss that later. Any other comments or thoughts about the story as far as Messiah? I'm bringing this up because, oh, yes, Alma.
He already has it.
He already has it. That's a good example. At this point in his life, while he's still alive, that's possible too. So the reason I wanted to jog your memory about this particular parable section, these parables aren't really a fair word, the story about Messiah's temptations, is that the Torah portion discusses this topic in more detail as far as what Messiah was given. Any time, for me personally, it's my personal Daniel Age's opinion, any time a scripture is cited by the Messiah, he is using it strictly as a reference for the entire passage. That's my opinion. Now, you can disagree with it, but that's my opinion. So if he cites a verse in the Torah, he's talking about the entire section that includes that verse. For example, when he's on the cross or stake dying, Ali, Ali, lama sabachthani, my God, have you forsaken me? Well, that is a quotation from an entire psalm that talks about him. So he instead of saying, okay, wait, let's stop. I'm going to recite the whole psalm to you, which is one method. While you're dying, that's not easy to do. Just saying that you may be a little exhausted, or I'm just going to give you the reference. You yourself can go check it out. So it's a citation of example of I'm giving you the reference verse, which you know well, and now go back, find where the verse is written in the Torah, and read what the whole context is. And that is what I, Messiah, am saying. Now, that's my opinion. I think the apostles did the same thing when they wrote. When they wrote a citation of a verse or a quotation, they're not citing the entire Torah passage or Tanakh passage, the entire prophecy that might be 3 or 4 chapters long. They're citing a reference for us to go back and check it out. So in Messiah's explanation, which he gave the devil, the adversary at this point, it goes into our Torah portion in 2 different citations. Actually, one could argue all 3 of them are there. So when he is talking to the devil or talking to Satan, he's referring to what we're going to read now. Now let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7. This is what Messiah was on his mind, not just for chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, and most 11, as well as chapter 6, 2 for that matter, was on his mind. He was thinking about these things while he was going with that 40 days of fasting and trial. 7 verse 12 says, "This shall be the reward when you hearken to these ordinances. You shall observe and perform them. Jehovah your God will safeguard you for the covenant and the kindness that he swore to your forefathers. He will love you, bless you, multiply you. He will bless the fruit of your womb, the fruit of your land, your grain, your wine, your oil, the offspring of your cattle, the flocks, your sheep, and goats, on the land that he swore to your forefathers to give to you. You'll be the most blessed of all the peoples. There'll be no infertile male or infertile female among you or among your animals. Jehovah will remove from you every illness and all the bad maladies of Egypt that you knew. He will not put them upon you, but will put them upon all your foes. You will devour all the peoples that Jehovah your God will deliver to you. Your eyes shall not pity them. You shall not worship their gods, for it is a snare for you. Perhaps you will say in your heart, 'These nations are more numerous than I. How will I be able to drive them out?' Do not fear them. You shall remember what Jehovah your God did to Pharaoh and to all of Egypt. The great tests that your eyes saw, the signs, the wonders, the strong hand, the outstretched arm which Jehovah your God took you out, so shall Jehovah your God do to all the peoples before whom you fear. Also, the hornet swarm will Jehovah your God send among them, until the survivors and the hidden ones perish before you. You shall not be broken before them, for Jehovah your God is among you. Great and fearful is God. Jehovah your God will thrust these nations from before you little by little. You will not be able to annihilate them quickly, lest the beasts of the fields increase against you. Jehovah your God will deliver them before you and will confound them with great confusion. Until their destruction, he will deliver their kings into your hand. You shall cause their name to perish from under the heaven. No man will stand up against you until you have destroyed them. The carved images of their gods you shall burn in fire. You shall not covet and take for yourselves the silver and gold that is upon them, lest you be ensnared by it, for it is an abomination of Jehovah your God. And you shall not bring an abomination to your home and become banned like it. You shall surely loathe it. You shall surely abominate it, for it is banned. The entire commandment that I command you today, you shall observe to perform, so that you may live and increase, and come and possess the land that Jehovah swore to your forefathers. You shall remember the entire road on which Jehovah your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness, so as to afflict you, to test you, to know what is in your heart, whether you would observe his commandments or not. He afflicted you and let you hunger. Then he fed you the manna that you did not know, nor did your fathers know, in order to make you know that not by bread alone does man live, rather by everything that emanates from the mouth of God does man live. Your garment did not wear out upon you, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that just as a father will chastise his son, so Jehovah your God chastises you. You should observe the commandments of Jehovah your God to go in his ways and fear him. For Jehovah your God is bringing you to a good land, a land with streams of water, of springs, and underground water coming forth in valley and mountain. A land of wheat and barley and grape and fig and pomegranate, a land of all oil olives and date honey. A land where you will eat bread without poverty. You will lack nothing there. A land whose stones are iron and from whose mountains you will mine copper. You will eat and you will be satisfied and blessed. You will regard for the good land that he gave you. Take care lest you forget Jehovah your God by not observing his commandments, his ordinances, his decrees, which I command you today. Lest you eat and be satisfied, and you build good houses and settle, and your cattle and sheep and goats increase, and you increase silver and gold for yourselves. And everything that you have will increase, and your heart will become haughty, and you will forget Jehovah your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery, who leads you through the great and awesome wilderness of snake, fiery serpent, scorpion, thirst, where there is no water, who brings forth water for you from the rock of the flint, who feeds you manna in the wilderness, which your forefathers knew not, in order to afflict you and in order to test you, to do good for you in your end. And you may say in your heart, my strength, the might of my hand made me all this wealth. Then you shall remember, Jehovah your God, that it is he who gives you strength to make wealth, in order to establish his covenant that he swore to your forefathers as this day. It should be that if you forget Jehovah your God and go after the gods of others and worship them and prostrate yourselves to them, I testify against you today that you will surely perish. Like the nations that Jehovah causes to perish before you, so will you perish because you will not have hearkened to the voice of Jehovah your God. Let's stop there for a minute. That was Deuteronomy chapter 7 and 8. 7 and 8, which I was reading. Now, if you notice, when we read that Torah portion, I didn't read the whole thing yet. This is the first half chapter, and halfway through 7 and most of 8, or all of 8. We obviously, the main citation, which we referred to, obviously, within Messiah's example when he gave the devils. So, in this context of chapter 8, which you just read, where is that citation? Meaning, what's being talked about before and after? What is the purpose of the, you shall not eat, you shall not live on bread alone, but even if she says the mouth of your God? What's going on in the chapter of 8? What did we just read? Any ideas, any thoughts or opinions on it? Don't forget God. That's a big point. Don't forget God. And when God points out, and we go to chapter 8, as the entire point of all this, or these various tests, is verse 3. It says, he afflicted you and let you hunger. He fed you manna in the wilderness that you didn't know, nor did your fathers know, in order to make you know that not by bread alone does it live, but rather everything that emanates from the mouth of God does man live. So he tested you all these things in order you to know. To know what? What were you knowing? Who's in charge? Go back to verse 2 a little bit. Half of the 2 it says, to test you. To know what is in your heart, whether you would observe his commandments or not. So when Messiah is being tested by the devil or Satan, and he makes this citation, what's he saying to us who are reading it? What's the purpose of being tested? So that God knows, and what you know, what is in you. What is in me? What is in us individually? What will we do? Have you been backed up in a corner, so to speak, metaphorically speaking, meaning that you are frustrated, you don't know what to do, and you tend to lash out sometimes, or you may cave and say, I give up. See, all those things are within inside of us. We decide, do I attack? Do I back down? When you in a difficult situation, you're being tested, right? When you do something, whatever your actions are, that's what's inside your heart. Whether you agree with it later or not, you say, whoops, that was a bad choice. That could happen. I get that. But there's still to finding out what is inside you, what's deep inside you. Yes, Jeff.
So rather than asking what's in your wallet, we should ask what's in your heart, right?
Exactly.
So when God is testing us, and mind you, he tested his own son. Why? To know what's inside of his heart. So God and Messiah, but God know what's inside of his heart. What would have happened if he had caved? Then we would know, God would know, and Messiah would know what's truly inside his heart. Say, well, God knows everything. Yeah, he knows everything. But if he knew everything, he would have no purpose of testing anyone. He wants us to learn. What's he teaching Messiah then? He's teaching Messiah what's inside of his own heart. Yes, Larry.
I always kind of felt that since he is omnipotent, that he knows, at least he has a pretty good idea how we're going to react, but we need to know. We need to know what we're going to do. And at that point, we know that he knows
what we're made of,
and we need to work on
and we
it.
Stick or with it, right?
I mean, almost in every case, we need to work on it.
Most of us, we need to work on it to improve. Well, it's important we understand that, because in Hebrews it cites that he was tested or suffered in order to learn, Messiah did, in order to learn obedience. So the testing was in order for he would learn to obey. Yes, Lee.
Maybe what's inside your heart also varies as you mature.
It does. It changes. Note, he did not test Messiah when he was 10. No offense to most 10-year-olds. I think most of them would probably couldn't stand that long. The right timing was right to test him at that point. Of course, it was obvious toward the end of his life or the tail end of his life because he was dying a few years later. But the point is, he tested a certain time and it can change. A baby doesn't have the same philosophies that a grown adult does. The same, they totally different experiences. They learn more. So we learn as we progress and we grow. So in Moses' citation, he's telling people, hey, you've been tested to find out what's inside you. How will you react when life is difficult? When problems arise. Not just minor problems, severe problems, life and death problems. We think minor problems, I personally categorize them as, you know, relationships, business, those are minor problems. When it minds you, when your life and death is involved, those are more critical to us. We tend to have more emotions tied up into our lives, the lives of our loved ones. We tend to react differently to them as they come along. Well, in Messiah's case, his own personal life is in his hands. He's willing to, he can change it, but he's not going to. He's going to follow through because he's trusting what God gave, of course, which is our Torah portion. Now, it's within inside this section, the whole purpose of that citation, as it explains in chapter 8, after he's given you, it, verse 4, it gave an example of what Moses was referring to when he told people that you should not live by bread alone, but what comes out of your mouth, of your mouth, your God. He gave the citation as proof. Verse 4, your garment didn't wear out upon you, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. So there's evidence, a proof, that if you trust, there will be proof. Now, the same thing can be argued, but wait a minute. But I don't have all the blessings that I want or need. I'm struggling. I'm having difficulties. Where is my proof for those? I'm modern day. We don't have, you know, clothing and shoe problems that wear out at that time. We weren't there, you know, 4,000 years ago almost, 3,500 years. We're here and now today. Our problems are a little different. We don't have to worry about our clothing and our shoes so much. We buy them. They're not too terribly expensive if we're willing to go acquire them and work for them. But our problem is still different because I personally run across this, not just in my own life, but other people as well, that they have frustrations that, well, I don't have the things that I need. Where is my God? What was that? Want. Well, there's want. You're right. There's want. There's also the things that we think we need. Because the difference between what I need versus what I think I need versus what I want so badly that I perceive I need it. Those are all different things. There are sometimes we want something so badly we perceive we need it. Well, yeah, that's not necessarily true. We just perceive we need it. But there's all the different categories. I shouldn't use them interchangeably, but they are different groups. That is true. I should be more careful with my wording when I say want versus need. But we do have those issues because they do come up to, and people do test. These people were asking the same problem. If you recall, when they were wandering through the wilderness, how many times they challenged Moses and God, saying, but we don't have any food. We don't have any water. We're suffering. The things that we need. Those things you need, right? Your body dies without food and water. So we do understand that is a need, not necessarily a want, but they still need certain things, yet God still provides. And the purpose was God to test them. All right, when push comes to shove, you get to the things that you need down to the need part, not the want part, but the need part, what are you going to do? Yes, Jeff.
Just a clarification. One of the things that's morphed over time in the English language is want and need, because actually they are synonymous. Want and need are synonymous, because thus, remember from the King James, I shall not be want.
That means need.
True. We have morphed want into desire.
Desire, that's
so
true.
So we've taken that and turned it into that, but really want does mean need. We've just...
Well, thank you for defending me. I appreciate it. Okay. Let's move forward, because this is an interesting section we're discussing today, and that there's a lot of details here, because it ties into our Haftor portion, as well as how Messiah is trying to relate to us, because there's some fundamental instruction being taught to us in this. So in this Torah portion, as I mentioned to when we read Matthew chapter 4, the first test that he gave was, of course, cited here in chapter 8 of Deuteronomy, the whole bread alone thing. And the purpose was to test what's inside of your heart. So God knows what's inside your heart. But there's other things that also that was also tested on him. For example, it says his second test, which was and go back to Matthew. His second question, second challenge, when the devil took him up into the holy city, this is Matthew chapter 4, verse 5. So the devil pinnacled the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning you, and their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash foot against a stone." Jesus said to him, "It is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." How is that tempting God? Any thoughts? Think of it. What does he mean by tempt? Say it louder. I didn't hear you.
To not trust him.
To not trust him? It's an interesting question. Interesting point. Yes, Pat?
I don't like that.
Right in your face.
To tempt God means to do something you know is foolish, like to jump off of a pinnacle and expect him to save you, or that's tempting God. You know, he gives us common sense to do things not foolishly, and that would be a foolish act.
So that's a fair comment. Yes, Myrna?
I would think that he's actually questioning Christ's identity as God himself. And so he's just saying, if you are truly God, And it's questioning Christ's identity.
It's a fair comment. Anything else? Other comments or thoughts? So the phrase he's using to tempt, it is worded a bit differently in our Torah. For example, if you jump to or go to Deuteronomy again. Now this is written two different places in two different ways, as far as what he's trying to relay. The same quotation, though, because Messiah, the way he worded it, said to tempt, the Hebrew phrase is to test him, to challenge him. So, oh, yes, Gretchen.
Or not, you know, tempt the Lord.
Right, to test him. The term is to challenge something, because note, the devil cited two scriptures that nothing, no harm will come to him. Well, how do you know that's true? Well, what the challenge would be, test whether these words of God are true or not. Find out if they're true or not. Test God. As opposed to, that's testing yourself necessarily, but he's testing God's words, whether the words themselves are in fact true. The idea is to test. So in Deuteronomy, let's go back. It's two different places. One's the Torah portion before this, and one's this current Torah portion. So let's go back to Deuteronomy, chapter 6, where the first example of what this means. And mind you, the Septuagint words is a little bit more like the form of how he's quoting it in the New Testament, but not quite the same. So anyway, so Deuteronomy chapter 6, the citation he's giving is in verse 16. There it is, verse 16. "You shall not test Jehovah your God as you tested him at Massah." Now, if you recall, the reference of Massah was, is God with us or not? Is his word true or not true? That was the original test. So in that citation, which Messiah is, the answer he's giving is, you do not test the word of God. Well, didn't God say, "Test me and see if I open the gates of heaven for you"? Remember that citation? God uses that phrase in an example when he says, test, for example, I think it's a tithing example for, I forgot which, it's in Deuteronomy as well. What was that? Malachi, thank you. To test, find out if this is true or not. Find out if I will bless you or not. Well, what are these two tests? They're not the same type of testing.
Massa.
Right. It's a type of test we're referring to. In the case of Deuteronomy, he references what kind of test are we talking about? Just because in Malachi as well, Deuteronomy, I think it says as well, as far as tests with regards to setting your funds aside and tithing, all that kind of stuff, test me and challenge me and see if it's not true. Well, that's a different kind of testing because this references to Massa, which is the testing, is God with us or not? Is he really going to save us and allow us to live or die? Those are two different kinds of tests. One's challenging whether or not God will bless us. The other one's challenging, is God with us? I mean, does he really even exist? The two different groups of testings, not the same things. So in this reference, the Messiah is quoting, he cites this particular style. Yes, Lee.
I agree with you. There's two types, and one would be example. Who do you think, one is a sin because he's putting himself to test God. We're his creation. He's our creator. He's everything. Mm-hmm. And then, which is a sin, I think. And then the other one's a teaching situation. So you know God better.
Right. You learn something from one versus the other way. You don't learn anything. It's a matter of just challenging God. Are you actually that powerful? Are you true? Are you lying to me or not? There's different things about us. And of course, obviously, it would kill him if he was wrong. So they are different categories of testing. Now, in his last citation, his last example, it says, in the verse of Matthew chapter 4, in verse 10, it says, Jesus said, this regarding this is the bowing down and worshiping Satan and worshiping the devil. Away with Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Now, that's also recorded in we're on chapter 6. Might as well be there. Deuteronomy 6 also has that one. It's in verse 13. It's also recorded in Deuteronomy 10 as well. So in chapter 6, verse 13 is the example, which is the citation. It says, Jehovah your God shall you fear, him shall you serve, and in his name shall you swear. Now, note that word's a little differently in our modern Bibles versus what Messiah was quoting. But also similarly recorded in chapter 10 of Deuteronomy. It also is the same thing, or something similar to it, I should say. Verse 20, which we haven't quite read all of it yet, but we'll get there. 10 verse 20, it says, Jehovah your God shall you fear. Him shall you serve, and to him shall you cleave, and in his name shall you swear. So in the citation which Messiah gives, he gives all of the citations of the examples to rebuttal his temptations, and brings him back to the Torah, the instructions. Well, what are the overall instructions given to us by Moses in this Torah portion? Well, the instruction was given in chapter 8. So what overall is Messiah trying to tell us? Chapter 8, verse 1 is what he's trying to tell everybody who's listening to this. The entire commandment that I command you today, you shall observe to perform, so that you may live and increase and come and possess the land that Jehovah swore to your forefathers. That's the overall theme that everything he was tested on fits under. All the tests he gave can be addressed by that comment. Everything you want is buried in there. And that's what we're learning. So, in this example that we just went through, we have obviously these different citations and the examples as far as how to live and what to live. But there are certain details that God gave that he values, inside this Torah portion, he lists them, that he values as being the most important aspects of our concepts, not that's your actions, but what you perceive, what you view as important to God. Because this controls what's the right word? It explains or expounds more thoroughly Messiah's personal viewpoint when it came to viewing God's scriptures. It's explained here in the Torah portion. So the Torah portion, it points out, excuse me, and let's go to chapter 10. Chapter 10, we're going to read the basic things that explain what Messiah's viewpoint would be if this is his Torah portion he's citing for all of his challenges and his tests. So in chapter 10, we'll start out, we read chapter 10. The whole thing is, we're going to read it, but it's, there's a few verses we're going to jump out. Actually, let's jump down to verse 12. Deuteronomy 10, verse 12. It's all part of Torah portion. It says, "Now, O Israel, what does Jehovah your God ask of you? Only to fear Jehovah your God, to go in all of his ways, and to love him, to serve Jehovah your God with all your heart, with all your soul, to observe the commandments of Jehovah and his decrees, which I command you today, for your benefit. Behold, to Jehovah your God are the heaven and the highest heavens, and the earth and everything that is in it. Only your forefathers did Jehovah cherish to love them. He chose their offspring after them, you, from among all these peoples, as it is this day." So what's he asking? What's his overall objective? What is the perspective Messiah is giving? Oh, that was Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12 and 13. Right. Love him. So fear and love and all those various things, those are emotions inside of us, but they're action words too. Those will control us. So when he's being tested for 40 days, what's in his mind? Food. What's in his mind? What's he dwelling on? What's giving him encouragement and strength? The words of God. But more importantly, you should fear only the Lord your God. Go in all his ways and love him. He's using those phrases, those mental thoughts, those Torah portions, that section to encourage him as he's battling the greatest tempter of all. That's what he's using. That's his reference. So I ask you, what's our reference? It's the same. When our challenges come, follow his example. What was his example? Go back to Torah, go back to instructions, and dwell on them. Mind you, the man memorized the Torah pretty well. I can't swear he knows everything. I didn't speak to him personally, but he could cite it really well. He probably had the whole thing memorized, just like the devil has it all memorized. He knows it all. But that's what he dwelled on. When he's going through challenges, difficulties, it doesn't matter what our difficulties are, what our challenges are, follow his example. Return and dwell on God's words. What did he say to do? And that is the example we live by, which most of us all know this. This isn't shocking. This isn't strange. But to pay attention, to remind ourselves. I don't know about you, but I've been through challenges myself. And sometimes I remember, okay, wait a minute, God. I know you didn't give me what I couldn't handle. Just focus my attention on you. And I go through pretty well. But sometimes I forget. I know the things I deviate a bit for a while before I realize, wait a minute, this isn't working. It's falling apart on me. Let's go back. So in Messiah's case, he used that to go back. He apparently dwelled up pretty regularly. That's what he's doing when he's doing his own personal one-on-one temptations to focus his attention on the Deuteronomy section in this idea of loving and focusing on God. So that's our challenge to do something similar as he did. Also in chapter 10, there's something else I want to point out to you, which is how we perceive ourselves in other ways, as far as how we, at least me personally, maybe not you particularly, how I see myself in my priorities. So chapter 10, jumping down a little bit, it says verse 16, thank you. So verse 16 chapter 10 says, "You shall cut away the barrier of your heart and no longer stiffen your neck. For Jehovah your God, he is the God of the powers, the Lord of the lords, a great and mighty and awesome, fearful God. who does not show favor, who does not accept a bribe. He carries out the judgment of an orphan and loves a proselyte to give him bread and garment. You shall love the proselyte, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Jehovah your God shall you fear. Him shall you serve, to him shall you cleave, and in his name shall you swear. He is your praise, he is your God, who did for you these great and awesome things that your eyes saw. With 70 souls did your ancestors descend to Egypt, and now Jehovah your God has made you like the stars of heaven. Verse 11 says, you shall love Jehovah your God. You shall safeguard his charge, his decrees, his ordinances, and his commandments all your days. I have a question for you. I know what his decrees are. I know what his ordinances are. I know what his commandments are. They're all listed right here. What's his charge? Do you know what a charge means? Right. It's what's your task? What's his task? I have to safeguard it. What is it? That's for me personally, how my relationship with God, that is one of the major components as far as how my relationship with God. But note, go back to verse chapter 10. There's an old English term. Oldie, it's not like that old. It's probably maybe 200 years old. Maybe not even that old. Probably a little younger than that. When a person has a charge, what does that mean? What means you're taking care of somebody else? that's what you owe in a debt. You're taking care of somebody else. Oh, she's my charge. Oh, it's all sort of she's my ward or he's my ward. If they were interchangeable, charge and ward were interchangeable. So, in chapter 10, he listed what his charge was. Verse 18, he carries out the judgment of the orphan, the widow, and loves the proselyte to give him bread and garment. Who's he taking care of? Who is God's charge? Who's his ward? The orphan, the widow, the proselyte to give them bread and garment. So, note, when he lists all these things, right, I know his decrees, the ordinance commandments, but his charge, to safeguard his charge, who am I safeguarding? I'm safeguarding God's charge, which is the orphan, the widow, and the proselyte, who he loves to give bread and garment. So that's his charge once he's taken care of. That's a huge component in what God prioritizes. Now let's jump to Messiah a little bit. Who did he go after? What group of people did he take care of? What kind of people were they? The wealthy, the important, the powerful? No. The weak, the orphan, the miserable, the charge, God's charge. So, not only did Messiah know his decrees, ordinances, commandments, like where all of us are to know, but his actions to demonstrate them, he took care of God's charge, his wards, which are his orphans, the widows, the proselytes, those who are struggling to strive and attach themselves to God. It explains a bit on Messiah's point. He says, I do what my father taught me. I do what my father does. I'm doing exactly what he did. Well, what was he doing? Taking care of his charge, the people who were his wards. Yes, Jeff.
And now you know why the anger of the Lord was expressed so vociferously through the prophet Yeshayahu about going after those particular groups and doing disjustice against them.
Exactly. And a lot of prophets did the same way. Amos went after it. Hosea went after it. Hey, guys, these are God's personal charge. He didn't charge to take care of the kings or take care of the priests. That was not his charge. That's not his priority. His words were these people who needed help. Yes, Larry.
True religion.
Yes, true religion. Taking care of these. This is our God. This is what God prioritizes. So he has his commandments and decrees. He has his ordinances, but then he uses them and takes care of the orphan, the widow, the proselyte, those who don't have anything, who are struggling to survive, those are his charge. So what's my job? And now mind you, Messiah gave me the example, when I'm challenged and having trials, focus my attention here. God's words, decrees, commandments, ordinances, all those things, that God is a source of these blessings, but what happens when I'm not going through a trial? When I'm not being tested at that moment in time, what do I do then? I take care of his charge. When I'm not in a trial, I'm being blessed this moment. Now, they may be, you know, few and far between or whatever. It makes no difference. When I'm not being tested, that was Messiah, by the way. Messiah, while he was being tested by the devil, if you call it devil or Satan, whatever you call him, was he busy healing the poor, the sick, and the miserables at that time period? Not during those testing periods, those 40 days. He was isolated. So when he's under his trials, he's under his burdens, it's okay to say, okay, everybody else, I need to isolate and focus and narrow down, to buckle down, so to speak. That's okay. He did the same thing. My buckling down means I go to God's words and focus on them. But when he was not under trial and misery and being tested, what was he doing? Taking care of God's charge. All those individuals that God said, these are mine to take care of. Yes, Larry.
The Apostle Paul said, earning money. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, like, you could go just so much and get it all that you need, but you should get a little more so that you can share it with other people that need it.
Yeah.
I don't remember where that was.
I'm not sure. That's not ringing a bell. I'm sure it's probably true. It's not ringing a bell, though, off the top of my head. So it's important. It explains a bit on Messiah's perspective and his priorities. So he knew God's words very, very well. He memorized them all. Not a problem. That was not a difficulty. But then once he memorized them and lived them, he then used his efforts to apply them to God's charge, which is the orphan, the fatherless, the widow, all those people. Well, fatherless, widow, orphan, same thing, but and proselytes. To focus attention upon them, to take care of them. So it tells me a bit on what God's priorities are. So verse 1 of chapter 11 says, you should love the Lord your God, you shall safeguard his charge, his decrees, his ordinances, and his commandments all the days. That's my priority. That's how I live. That's how I prioritize what is important to me and to God. Now, I want to jump back a little bit. I have some time. This is good. Jump back a little bit to chapter 9. Let's go back a little bit to Deuteronomy chapter 9. I'm giving you different points, different things to all cite so I can give you an overall perspective on what's happening. Chapter 9. I made a reference to this earlier, that we as humans tend to question, at least I do sometimes, but not often, but occasionally. I don't do it so much anymore, but I did when I was younger. How come I don't have the blessings I am expecting or needing right now? Chapter 9, let's jump to go back to verse 7. Chapter 7 says, remember, do not forget that you provoked Jehovah your God in the wilderness. From the day you left the land of Egypt until your arrival at this place, you have been rebels against Jehovah. And at Horeb you provoked Jehovah, and Jehovah became angry with you to destroy you. Then I ascended the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of covenant that Jehovah sealed with you. I remained in the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Bread I did not eat, water I did not drink. And Jehovah gave me the two stone tablets inscribed the finger of Jehovah, and on them were all the words Jehovah spoke with you on the mountain, in the midst of the fire, on the day of the congregation. It was the end of 40 days and 40 nights. Jehovah gave me the two stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant. Then Jehovah said to me, arise, descend quickly from here. The people that you took out of Egypt have become corrupt. They have strayed quickly from the way that I commanded them. They made themselves a molten image. Jehovah said to me, saying, I have seen this people. Behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Release me, and I shall destroy them and erase their name from the heavens. And I shall make you a mightier, more numerous nation than they. So I turned and descended from the mountain as the mountain was burning in fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I saw, and behold, you had sinned, Jehovah your God. You made yourselves a molten calf. You strayed quickly from the way that Jehovah commanded you. I grasped the two tablets and threw them from my two hands. I smashed them before your eyes. Now I threw myself down before Jehovah as the first time, 40 days and 40 nights. Bread I did not eat, water I did not drink, because of your entire sin that you committed, to do that which is evil in the eyes of Jehovah, to anger him. For I was terrified of the wrath, the blazing anger with which Jehovah had been provoked against you to destroy you. Jehovah hearkens to me at that time as well. Jehovah became very angry with Aaron to destroy him. So I prayed also for Aaron at that time, that your sin that you committed, the calf, I took and burned it in the fire. I pounded it, grinding it well until it was fine as dust. I threw its dust the brook that descended from the mountain. When we have our trials and difficulties, and we learn, and God learns what's inside of our heart to know what's inside of us, and we expect or anticipating the blessings God's supposed to give, the promises he gave, what else is supposed to be in our minds? What else was to focus on? What's he telling these people to not forget? Where you came from, what you were doing, what your actions are, where you started from, to not forget that part. That's an important component in our blessings and our desire to follow the decrees, the ordinances, take care of God's charge, all those details. When we're having trials and difficulties and tests, he points out, verse 7, do not forget. You provoked God to destroy you. How many of us have provoked God to destroy us? For God to destroy us? Well, probably every one of us at some point in our lives. We did something evil or rotten enough that, oh, well, I know the Torah says that's a death penalty. Oops. Well, that's provoking God to destroy you. For God to destroy me. Those oops. Not forget those components. So even though you get blessings or desire them or say, hey, well, I'm following God as best I can, don't forget where you came from. That's a big deal. It matters to him. Don't forget that. That's a remembered component. So we learn about Messiah and all these great things and the challenges he went through and the various tests he had to go through and what he focused attention upon. He didn't just focus attention strictly upon the words of God. He focused attention strictly upon the value system God has as far as who's important, who's not, who he takes care of. He also remembered, where did we come from? Where did we come from? What does that mean? Don't raise your hands, but each of us came from somewhere, from a past, from a difficulty, from a stressful situation, or whatever we did in our lives, from children up through adulthood. We had our weaknesses and our weak points. Never forget those components. Because those, as it took, as it points out here, even Aaron, the second probably most righteous man who ever lived, was the point of God executing him. It's a hard place to be. I say second because Moses probably outbeat him. Other than Messiah, we're not discussing him. He's a separate category. But that's a difficult place that God was going to destroy Aaron as well. Unless Moses had to intercede on his behalf. That's a big deal to be in that position. And in Aaron's position, imagine yourself as Aaron. God chose you to be a high priest. The second most important person in the entire congregation. But yet he was going to kill you just a few months earlier. Actually, about a year earlier. He was going to kill you a year earlier because of your actions. So in Aaron's case, what humbling aspect that put upon you. But God has blessed me and brought me up this place. But just a year ago, he was going to kill me and all my descendants and everybody who ever lived. I was at that point of execution and God said, through Moses had prayed for me on my behalf. God said, I'm going to allow Aaron to live. And not only that, he becomes the high priest, the first high priest I've ever created. That's a humbling place to be in Aaron's shoes. So is it not also a humbling place to be in our own shoes? When we are blessed, realizing, wait a minute, I was once at ruin, once at destruction, once at God saying, I don't want you or need you anymore. Yet he allows us to live and move forward as we learn his decrees, his commandments, his charge, to do all those tasks that he said, do these commandments, follow these instructions. They're important things to remember to do. this leads me personally to a particular jumping off point. In our Torah portion, there was a phrase here that had written out very, I guess, what's the right word? Loaded. Verse 10 of chapter 9, it said, "And the Yahweh had given me the two stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God, and on them were all the words Yahweh spoke with you on the mountain, amidst the fire on the day of the congregation." God writing, inscribing with a finger on those tablets. Our Haftor portion has a, what's the right word? An interesting reference to this. I'm going to jump to Isaiah, to our Haftor portion. Because this also points to our Messiah. Isaiah chapter 49. Our Haftorah portion discusses this topic. Now, Haftorah portion, it goes from Isaiah 49, middle of chapter, so through all 50 and part of 51. So this reference of inscribing into these stone tablets, now we obviously use the references or the examples of, you know, writing God's commandments on your heart's a stone. We get that metaphor pretty well, right? You all heard that metaphor, right? That your heart's a stone, he'll make them of flesh, he'll write his commandments in your hearts. And you've heard that before, right? Okay, he's not the only one who writes in your hearts. He writes on other things as well. He writes on other things also, not just your heart. He writes on his own hands. Have you taken notes in your hands before? Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a piece of paper. And you write down. Yeah, he does that too. Funny, but God has the same habit. Now, he writes something different than we do. So in Isaiah 49, I'm going to read something about what he is writing. So in better handwriting, probably does. Isaiah 49, this is our Haftorah portion. This is not exactly in the middle of a prophecy, but it's partially in the middle. I mean, Isaiah is sending a set of prophecies, or set of scriptures or declarations out periodically. Now, most prophets, unlike Daniel, didn't write down so much. That was not their thing, was not writing down everything they said. They had scribes that did that work. They were more of the soapbox preacher. Stand up there in the books and give his attention in the streets and yell and scream. And that's most of what they did. Now, they had people who wrote things down for them. Daniel's, the other hand, was the exact opposite. He was a book writer. He wrote everything down. He was not the soapbox preacher. He didn't stand up there and yell and scream. That was not his thing. More reserved, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so Daniel did, but Isaiah does. So Isaiah gives a series of declarations or prophecies over a period of time, and not necessarily all at the same moment in time. It could be lapsed by a few days, a few weeks, in some cases a year or two, but they're chunks at a time. So this is in the middle of a set of chunks of prophecies he gives out. So in Isaiah chapter 49, we're jumping in here into one of his batches that he had given up. This batch continues on for a while. So Isaiah 49, jump down to verse 14. This is where our Haftorah portion begins. It says, "Zion said, Yehovah has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me. Can a woman forget her baby or not feel compassion for the child of her womb? Even these may forget, but I would not forget." I'm going to stop there for a minute to explain what just happened, what just said. Zion is a region. We think of, oh, well, it's the mountain of God, it's Jerusalem. Well, it's a little bigger and smaller and mix of that. Zion is a conceptual ideal of what Jerusalem could or should be. Or daughter of Zion, for that term, or the daughter of Jerusalem. Those are ideas. Zion is speaking. Now, Zion is a place. It's not a human. But it's being personified as speaking. God has forgotten me. Now, To be fair, in the set of these prophecies Isaiah is giving, Zion is being abandoned, emptied. People are leaving, being evacuated and hauled away in captivity. So Zion, the city of the Jerusalem left over, is saying, well, where is everybody? They're all gone. I don't have anyone. People have left. God's people are not with me anymore. So Zion's complaining, God, you've forsaken me. You've forgotten who I, you've forgotten me completely. I'm emptied. That's what the prophecy is being said. And God's point is, can a woman forget her baby? No. In case you're wondering that, you haven't been married, you haven't been married, have a kid, they don't forget their babies. Or not feel compassion for the child of her womb. Even these things, woman can do those things, but I will not forget for Zion. Here's his writing on his hands to not forget. Behold, I have inscribed, which means this isn't just writing, this is engraved with a chisel. I have chiseled you upon the palms of my hands. Your walls before me always. Your children will hasten to return, and your ruiners and your destroyers will leave you. This is Isaiah chapter 49, that was verse 14, 15, and 16. So that is where, so God writes, so what is God writing in this palm of his hand? Yes.
It's not an allusion to like messianic.
It is. There is some reference to Messiah in this section as far as what's being written and what's being inscribed. Now, he chiseled with his own finger upon those stones, the commandments of God. But he chisels upon his own palms, Zion. The place, the ideal place of a city to dwell. Now, Zion, of course, I want to point something out to you in this. It is Jerusalem in many ways. It's the ideal form or the improved version of Jerusalem. I've never been to Jerusalem. Some of you probably have. I've never been there. I've been told a lot about it, and a lot of people have had their stories and this, that, and the other thing. I believe, recall correctly, Jerusalem is the most whored out capital in the world, which means there are more religions that attach themselves to Jerusalem than any other city on earth. Yeah, prostitute. That's the most whored out prostitute or harlotried out city I've ever heard of. No other country has a city that has that many different religions attaching their identity to it. I've never heard of one. If you've heard of one, let me know. But I've yet to hear of one. It doesn't matter where the city is, nothing is as bad as Jerusalem is. From Islam to Judaism to the various varieties of Christianity, the various varieties of Islam for that matter too, and a few others. Yes, worse than New York. There's nothing that's quite as bad as that is. But, so that is not, the ideal version of Zion, is it? Is that Jerusalem today, is that the ideal version of Zion? No, it is not. What is the ideal version of Zion? Well, how many lovers does it have? The ideal version is one. David has one God, one belief, one truth, one set. So this is how we isolate these things. That Zion is the idealized version of what Jerusalem should be, but isn't. Okay, so get these things straightened out. Right, that is a cleaned up. When it comes down to God, has cleaned up and cleaned it up and adorned it properly as a bride adorned for her husband, as it records Revelations. That is the ideal version, the corrected or cleaned up version. Let's continue on. Raise your eyes all around. Mind you, he's talking to Zion as if it's an identity. Raise your eyes all around and see. They have all gathered. They have come to you as I live. The word of Yehovah, I swear that you will clothe yourself with them like all jewelry and adorn yourself like a bride. What is Zion adorning herself with? Your children will hasten to return. So that should tell us the reference you gave. When you gave it was about the Jerusalem coming down, right? Adorned. What's she adorned with? Her children. What's she look like? Her children. It's this, all the people. That is her adornment, the people, her children. As, verse 19, as for your ruined desolations and your devastated land, you will now become crowded with inhabitants. And those who would devour you will be distanced. I mean, those who destroyed you are long since gone away. Your harlotry, you know, mixed of whatever it was, are gone away. The children from whom you had been bereaved will yet say in your ears, the place is just too crowded for me. Move aside from me, that I may dwell. I mean, it will be so thoroughly packed. So in these children, I have a question for you. What kind of children are these individuals? Well, what are the examples that Messiah gave to us? What do we live by? Well, what did he live by? He lived by the words that proceeded out of the mouth of God. You don't live by bread alone, right? See the words that every man lives, by, not by bread alone, but the words go out of the mouth of God, the proceeding of the mouth of God. That's Messiah living by. Those are the people that he's referring to, that kind of individual. Because again, we're referring to the idealized form of Zion, the idealized version, the perfect version. And what are her children? The ones that follow that image, that example Messiah gave to us. And he wrote this, of course, God is writing this on his palms, not forget. That's what to remember. He's writing upon his hands. You don't usually forget things when they're written on your hand. Anybody ever done that? You write on your hand and you see it all the time. Well, I thought you sweat, but he doesn't sweat. He's God. he doesn't sweat. So he's not forgetting it. It's an important thing to remember. So all these blessings and all these trials and temptation difficulties that Messiah went through, mind you, what's always in his mind? God's always in his mind. God's word's always in his mind. That's always in his mind. He is the idealized, the perfect child of Zion. So when this ideal Zion shows up, a bride adorned for her husband, and she's adorned with her children, what do they look like? Well, like him. He's the idealized form of person. Zion is the idealized form of Jerusalem. They are the perfect match. So what are all the children? The idealized image of these examples of Messiah himself. And he'll be so crowded so much that the people say, move aside, there's not enough room here. There's so many of us that you will that there's not enough room. Because he says, and you, Zion, will say in your heart, verse 21, who has begotten me these? For I have been bereaved and alone and in exile and a wanderer. So who has reared all these? Behold, I had been left all by myself. Where are all these from? So these people, her children, the Zion's being built for and adorned for and being decorated with, they aren't from her, are they? They grew from somewhere else. Right, they came from somewhere else. But yet they are the idealized form, the perfect children to adorn yourself with. Verse 22 says, for thus says Jehovah God, behold, I will raise my hand toward the nations. I will hoist my banner towards peoples, and they will bring your children in their arms. Your daughters will be carried on their shoulders. Kings will be your nurturers, and their princesses your wet nurses. With face to the ground, they will prostrate themselves to you. They will lick the dust of your feet. Then you will know that I am Jehovah, and those who put their hope in me shall not be ashamed. All these words that he's given, the Messiah dwells on day and night through all of his trials and temptations. All the difficulties beside his direct focus in life while he's thriving and surviving, he's focused attention all upon God throughout his whole existence. That's what he does. And of course, we're supposed to mimic that image, that example, that style of life as it instructs us to do. And if we do those things, what happens? Now, we aren't from Zion. I've never been there. I'm sure most of you have never been there. Never seen it. I read about it, that's all I got. Not from there. None of us are from there. But what's going to happen? We match that ideal child. We are as children of Zion. Verse 24. Could loot be retrieved from a warrior, or could justly captured person be allowed to escape? Yet thus says Jehovah, even the captives of a warrior can be retrieved, and the booty of fierce men can escape. I myself will take up your cause, and I myself will save your children, and I will feed your tormentors with their own flesh, and they'll become drunk of their own blood, as if on sweet wine. Then all the flesh will know that I am Jehovah, your Savior and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. This is my personal viewpoint on this. I realize you had a different viewpoint. But when God is making this perspective, when he's discussing these topics, and Messiah is living them as his own life, he's focused the attention upon God's words and instruction to give him inspiration. Because God's testing Messiah just like he tests any of us to find out what's inside of Messiah's heart. And what did he find in Messiah's heart? He found obedience. So what are our trials and tests for? But to find out what's inside of our heart. And what should God hopefully find? Hopefully he finds obedience. And we find that obedience, regardless of where we're from, this country, that country, this region, this history, that family line, who cares? Regardless of where we're from, as Zion points out, I have no children. They're all gone. God says, don't worry. I know where they're at. I've found them. I'm going to bring them back. I'll decorate you with them. It may not be what you necessarily look like. I don't know if you'd be emeralds or rubies or whatever. I don't care what you look like. God decides what you look like. But that is the decoration he's using. So that's the example where we live. If we live God's example, live Messiah's example, what are we doing? We're living by God's words. Pretty straightforward. Nothing shocking about that. But we use them not just as words to live by, but also words to walk through our trials by. Messiah did. And we're not living our trials, our difficulties, or struggles. What are we doing? We're using those same words to bless God's charge. The people he says, take care of these individuals. That's how Messiah lived. It's a lot. That's what he did. And God said, that's one of my children. I'm putting him or her or she or all of them, whoever they are, be as decorations for my city, for Zion. So as a bride adorned for her husband, what's she going to look like? Look around you. Look like all of us. That's what she looks like. That's what she is. That's what she looks like. That's an important thing that we see it. It's all around us. Follow the example of how to live, and then you can see what it looks like. It's a blessing. It's not always immediate when we expect it, but it's still a blessing. Does it make sense? Hopefully it does. I hope it makes sense. To me, this Torah portion is an important thing to focus my attention on because Messiah is using it to focus his own personal thoughts, his own personal viewpoint, to control and know what's inside of his own heart. If he uses the Torah to do that, I need to also. Now, Messiah could have quoted hundreds of scriptures that have chosen to give him inspiration in his answers. He didn't choose hundreds. He had a small set with inside of Deuteronomy, just a few chapters there that focus attention. All of them focus on loving God, following his ordinances, his commandments, his instructions, and that's how you get through your difficulties. And knowing that that's where your blessings come from. God's words. He was good at it. He's the best at it. And that's what he did. That's the instruction he gave us. So I do my best to try to follow it. I'm not perfect at it, but I try. I'm sure most of you try as well. We all have our trials, difficulties, but that's what we have to focus on. This Torah portion focuses that attention, at least it gets my attention on that. And as long as I do that, I know what God's trust is, his charge to me is, what I must do, and how I must live my life. How all of us live our lives. How all of us teach our children to live their lives. The examples we are. Just like Messiah was example. So I find this Torah portion important in that respect, personally. Any questions or comments regarding this Torah portion or the Haftorah portion or anything we discussed today, I'll entertain anything you wish. I have a few minutes left. Otherwise, we will close. All right, let's close in prayer then. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for our time with you to study your ways, to listen to your voice, to learn the difficulties, the challenges you give us, that they are for our benefit and for yours. May you bless us and help us to follow you as best we can. You are our wisdom, the words you've given to us, Father. Help us be wise. We ask you to bless us, Father. Bless the rest of our Shabbat today, Father, that we will celebrate with one another, to visit, to share the great things you taught us. We glorify you, Father, and ask your blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.